More than 64,000 Americans died from drug overdoses last year. That's more people than would fill a stadium the size of Soldier Field. And after President Trump's announcement last week that this is a public health crisis, we check in on what Illinois is doing to fight the opioid epidemic.
We need something that can galvanize the conversation, that people go from saying individuals with opioid misuse disorders should be shunned and stigmatized to saying they're our friends and neighbors.
That's Illinois Department of Public Health Director Nirav Shah. Plus, State Representative Jeannie Ives is fundraising and exploring a challenge to Governor Rauner's reelection bid. Here she is on Illinois Channel TV.
I'm not going to divulge the amount of money, but I'll tell you what, I honestly think Rauner could spend almost all of his fortune and not redeem his reputation.
But first, what doctors and hospitals should do to stop the rising number of women who are dying during childbirth. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Today on the program, we're focusing on two important healthcare issues that have gotten more attention in recent weeks, the U.S. opioid epidemic and the rising death rate of mothers during childbirth. We're going to be talking more about how Illinois state government and social service agencies are responding to the opioid crisis later this hour. But first, around the world, industrialized countries have gotten better at tracking and stopping deaths related to pregnancy and childbirth. That is, except for right here in the U.S. We're actually the only developed country in the world where the rate at which women are dying during childbirth has been rising since 2000. That's according to some of our best estimates. And a new article by ProPublica published just last week shows we might not even be getting that first step right. The article identifies, quote, gaping holes in the way we gather information on maternal deaths. This, of course, makes it all the more difficult to try and limit that number in the future. I'm joined now by Dr. Joan Briller. She's a professor of medicine at University of Illinois Chicago. Abby Cook is with me as well. She's a senior research specialist with UIC's Center on Research on Women and Gender. Dr. Briller, Abby, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks so much for having us. Good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Briller, if I'm a doctor with a patient who's just given birth, can you just kind of walk us through what are the most important things that you should be looking for?
Well, I think, did the birth go okay? Is there any evidence that the woman is having any complications from the birth? Is the blood pressure okay? Is there any evidence that she's having abnormal bleeding? And I think one of the things we're learning is that the risk of cardiovascular disease is actually increasing as a cause of mortality during pregnancy. And is there any evidence that there are any cardiac symptoms?
And that's interesting, Dr. Briller, because we know that when we already look at research that cardiac symptoms in women is already something that is kind of, we know this, right? Doctors kind of already have been overlooking this or maybe not paying much attention to women having cardiac issues as men have. Women present differently with cardiac issues. Is that part of the issue here?
I think that's some of the issue, although in fact, overall, we're doing much better. So actually, since 1985, for many years, more women died every year from cardiovascular disease than men, but that has just started to come down. And this year, we'll actually have fewer deaths in women than in men. And I think that reflects overall a better sense of understanding of cardiac disease in women, and then also getting messages out to both the women themselves that they're at risk of cardiac disease and the healthcare providers about some of the things to look for. And one of the issues, I think, with pregnancy is that some of the symptoms that may be quote-unquote normal pregnancy can overlap with heart symptoms. And many women don't think they might be at risk if they're in their 30s and 40s.
And what are those symptoms?
Well, we know that heart failure or cardiomyopathy associated with pregnancy is one of the big causes of mortality. And a lot of those symptoms tend to overlap. So a woman may have leg swelling, and that's considered a normal part of pregnancy, or she may feel she has more shortness of breath. or that she doesn't have as much ability to do the usual daily activities she would have been done before. And she says, you know, I'm pregnant. The heart's got to do a lot more work to get the blood supply out to the baby, and this is all part and parcel of normal pregnancy. And so they don't go seek further attention. And similarly, the physicians or the other healthcare providers may be thinking the same thing.
I'm speaking with Dr. Joan Briller. She teaches medicine at UIC. Abby Cook is on the line with us as well. She's also at UIC Center for Research on Women and Gender, where she's a senior research specialist. Abby, I wonder if you could just walk us back a minute just to the fact that when we look at numbers, it may be shocking to people that among industrialized nations, the U.S. Is not doing great at this. The rate at which women are dying during childbirth has been rising. Can you take us a step back and just help us understand why we think this might be happening?
Sure. In recent years, there has been increasing attention to this problem because, as you said, we are really the only industrialized country where maternal mortality seems to be rising. There are a few issues with how we keep track of it, the surveillance that we do. The standard birth or death certificate in the U.S., which hasn't been fully adopted by all states but is used in the majority of states, contains a checkbox to identify women who die while pregnant or within 1 year of pregnancy. There are some problems with how that gets completed. A lot of times, if a woman dies in the late postpartum period, the person who's certifying the death certificate may not be aware that the woman was pregnant within a year. In addition, we do think that conducting better surveillance, we think the actual numbers of mortality are going up, and we don't fully understand why. That's part of the problem. As Dr. Briller said, we do know that cardiovascular disease has taken a much greater proportion of the maternal mortalities compared with past typical obstetric causes like hemorrhage and infection.
So it's not necessarily, I think it's an important point of clarification here, it's not necessarily also the amount of women that are dying during childbirth. It sounds like the amount of women that are dying after childbirth as a result of not getting proper care and recognition of symptoms that may have arisen while they were pregnant. Is that right, Abby?
That's correct. I don't think that most people realize that the effects of pregnancy on the heart, as Dr. Briller was talking about cardiomyopathy, can affect a woman up into almost a year postpartum, as well as some hypertensive disorders such as preeclampsia or eclampsia. A woman can continue to suffer from that condition following delivery as well.
Dr. Briller, what are the most common preventable causes of death for mothers in Illinois? Is it these cardiac issues? When Abby also mentioned also eclampsia?
Well, I think that there's no question that cardiovascular disease has a large component that's preventable. When we looked at the deaths in Illinois over the last 10 years, we found that about 28% of them, based on a perinatal center review, were felt to be preventable. For some of the other causes of death, the preventability might be greater or it might be somewhat less. So for some vascular causes, it might be that it's actually less likely to be preventable, but for other things, it may be more preventable. So that depends a little on what the etiology or what the reason for the woman dying is. So things like hemorrhage and some psychiatric causes may be more preventable. But there's no question that it is that you can prevent a good portion of the deaths.
We have a question on Twitter, by the way. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our handle's 21STShow. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Joan, perhaps you can take this, Dr. Briller. Samantha was asking on Twitter, how much is age a contributing factor? And she said, I know most of my peers are having children much later than our parents' generation.
I think age probably is a contributing factor. So some of the factors that seem to come up when you go through the studies are that women are getting pregnant older, and it makes me cringe a little to hear that that's considered age 30. But But to be older may put you at increased risk. And the other factors that seem to be related are increased risk factors for cardiovascular disease. So there's more obesity, more hypertension, more type 2 diabetes, and those may put people at increased risk for diseases that then during pregnancy seem to get exacerbated.
And so when we look at, can I just ask you also just about the information side of this and go back to that, just because it seems like part of this is a problem of just knowing the information. You said that you all had done research, 28% of them you had found that there was preventability. Is that correct?
That's correct, for the cardiovascular disease.
For cardiovascular disease. What about in general? What about all of the, or were there other, so that's cardiovascular disease. You mentioned diabetes, hypertension. Are there other factors here we're not talking about?
Abby, do you want to take that for some
general,
of the other?
Sure. In general, approximately a third of pregnancy-related deaths are considered to be potentially preventable. We look for factors associated with preventability that may be action or inaction on the part of the provider, the healthcare system, or the patient. So in the case of something like hemorrhage, we typically see that there may have been a delay in recognizing that the woman was bleeding excessively. And once recognized, there may be a delay in action. So that's one example of the sort of preventability that we see frequently.
Mm-hmm. And Abby, when we think about that preventability, you mentioned on behalf of the provider, what kind of things do we think providers should be doing apart from hemorrhaging? It sounds like that's something where are there more checklists? Sort of like do we need to make changes to what providers are doing, what hospitals are doing after pregnancy to check in on women?
Well, I think we are seeing in our statewide review meetings, I think we're seeing some breakdowns of coordination of care when women come to the emergency room postpartum. It's really important that obstetrics is consulted, and that doesn't always happen. The provider doesn't even always recognize that the woman is postpartum. So there are some coordination of care that could be improved in general, and we're working on that. The state is in the process of implementing some safety bundles around specific topics. In this case, it's around hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. So that involves a number of interrelated initiatives to improve the management of hypertensive disorders in the hospital.
And when you say safety bundles, what does that mean?
Well, it's a sort of constellation of interventions and training for providers. They've been developed in the past several years, oftentimes coming out of California Quality Collaboratives. It's a group of education and protocols, like you said, possibly checklists of the activities that should take place when a hypertensive crisis is identified or when a hemorrhage is identified.
Dr. Briller, Abby mentioned California, and I just wanted to ask, because it seems like California has been doing the best job with this. They've actually been bucking the national trend. Their maternal mortality numbers are going down. And I just wondered if you could jump in and ask and answer a little bit more about what they're doing.
Well, I think actually Illinois has taken some things from them, and we've also implemented a hemorrhage education project. And I think that's helped. But California has implemented a hemorrhage protocol with education across the state, and they also have a hypertension bundle, which we're adopting in Illinois, a similar bundle in Illinois. And they're working on a cardiovascular bundle now. It's not yet out. But I think California has been very proactive in terms of coming up with bundles of information, and that includes actually patient care information to go out to women in terms of signs and symptoms to look for. And some of those educational handouts for the women are both in English and in Spanish, which means you can reach a wider number of people. And when I think about heart disease in women in general, I think when we go back and look at some of the educational interventions that have been done across the country just to educate women that they're at risk of heart disease, that doing that also helps in terms of making people aware that there is a potential risk, and if they have something that makes them feel something's not right, then they can go talk to their healthcare provider and be proactive on their own part.
That's my last question to both of you. We just have about a minute left, but Dr. Briller, I wonder if briefly you could just say what you think women who are going through this on the patient side, what they should be aware of, and also their partners who are with them going through this.
Well, I think there are two things. I always say that education about risk factors for things gives you the chance to know what you're at risk of doing. And then when you have symptoms and you feel that something's not right, I think it's very important that you be proactive for yourself and get care in that regard.
Abby?
Yes, I would just underscore what Dr. Briller said about making sure that people advocate strongly. If you feel that something's not right, definitely make that clear, and don't take this is just normal for an answer if a woman or her partner feels that that is not the case.
Right. So part of this is also, it sounds like, education needed on all fronts, both from hospitals and from on the patient side, Dr. Briller, to help improve this?
That's correct. I think we all have to do the best at each end.
That's Dr. Joan Briller. She teaches. She's a professor of medicine at UIC. I want to thank Abby Cook as well. She's a senior research specialist at UIC's Center for Research on Women and Gender. We'll tweet out that ProPublica article, by the way, that sparked this conversation about mortality among women during and after childbirth. We're going to continue our conversation shifting from health and childbirth to the opioid epidemic and President Trump's announcement last Thursday declaring this a public health emergency. We'll explain what that means and what Illinois is doing to combat this. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last year, about 64,000 people in the United States died from drug overdoses. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That number isn't just the highest on record. To give you some perspective, that's more than the total number of American military members who died during the Vietnam War. On Thursday, President Trump officially declared our country's opioid epidemic as a public health emergency. Here in Illinois, the number of drug overdose deaths is up for every race and age group, and treatment and addiction agencies were hit hard when the state government couldn't agree on a budget for more than 2 years. So now, as this crisis continues, today we want to spend a little bit of time looking at what state officials are doing to address this problem. I'm joined now by State Senator Don Harmon. He's a Democrat. He represents Illinois' 39th District, which includes parts of Cook and DuPage County and the West Chicago suburbs. Senator Harmon, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having me again, Nyla. Great to be with you.
Yes. Also on the line with us is Dr. Nirav Shah. He's director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Director Shah, welcome back to the 21st as well.
Good morning, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Director Shah, let's start with you. The president is calling this a public health emergency, and I think we should just make a distinction in the terminology, right? Because this is different than a national emergency, which means, for example, there's more money for FEMA dollars. What does a public health emergency mean?
Well, what a public health emergency, as compared to a national emergency, what that entails is a declaration by the federal government that there are sufficient conditions that exist that present an immediate threat to health, life, or safety. Really what that means in operational terms is that certain federal regulations that otherwise govern how federal money must be spent and allocated can be changed or can be suspended. It also means that there is additional technical resources that are made available to states to help us navigate the opioid crisis and figure out our best path forward.
And Director Shaw, what was your reaction to the president's announcement last week? I mean, do you think that, I'm just curious your thoughts on declaring it a public health emergency, how you feel like that fits into the reality of what's happening right now?
Well, when the president of the United States, or indeed any elected official in a high-ranking position of that nature, is talking about an issue, that really paves the way for those of us at the state and local level to pick up on that conversation and contextualize it for our local or state-level audiences. And that's what I've been trying to do, and I've been using that as an entree to talk about the opioid crisis and let folks know that it's not something that affects other parts of the United States. It is very much a crisis that affects us here in Illinois. Would I have loved to have seen some additional federal dollars attached to that declaration? Absolutely. But the mere fact that we're able to have now a space to have a conversation about the crisis and bring it home for folks, to let them know that their friends, their family, their loved ones, those they worship with, might in themselves be grappling with substance use, that's a great entree and a great place to start the discussion.
Senator Harmon, what about you? Do you wish the president had declared this a national emergency so perhaps there would be more federal dollars dedicated to addressing this problem?
Well, I think it is a national emergency, and while I appreciate the recognition from Washington, if it's not accompanied with the resources to combat and solve this problem, then I worry it's just words and no action.
So, Senator Harmon, one of the reasons we asked you to come on is because you're going to introduce a bill called the Alternatives to Opioids Act. What's the idea behind this?
Well, we're wrestling with this public health crisis across the state of Illinois. And we had a hearing in Springfield last spring where we heard from patients who had been prescribed opioids and had become quite dependent on them, and doctors who were involved as well. And the anecdotal evidence was stunning. The patients who were able to participate in a medical cannabis program were able to dramatically reduce their use of opioids. Some left the using opioids behind altogether. And the science seems to be keeping up and catching up with the anecdotal evidence we heard. So the bill I'm going to introduce next week would allow patients who have been or would otherwise be prescribed opioids to temporarily participate in the medical cannabis program in order to keep them from becoming dependent on opioids.
You know, Senator Harmon, I'm just curious about that. You know, the medical cannabis program in Illinois has it's taken quite a bit of time to get it off, you know, to get it off to starting. And there's been lots of news reports about dispensaries and how complicated the process is and how long it takes to get a medical cannabis card. Are you concerned about that and sort of the existing program? Do you think that there's enough infrastructure in place right now to make this a sustainable alternative for people?
I do, and for two reasons. One, I think the industry itself is up and running smoothly. The more important question that you asked is about how long it takes to get a card. What I'm proposing is that we apply to the opioid patients the same rubric we're using for patients who are using medical cannabis as a palliative measure as they approach death. So it would be a expedited process that would allow patients who would otherwise be getting the opioid prescription to participate immediately in the medical cannabis program.
And what would this bill require in terms of money, Senator Harmon?
I really don't think it requires much at all. We use all of the existing infrastructure that the state departments regulating the program already have in place. There would be an additional number of patients, but I trust that the department has contemplated that growth in the number of patients over time, and we'd simply ask them to use the resources already at their disposal.
That's Senator Don Harmon. He's a Democratic state senator. He's been talking to us about this bill that he plans to introduce next week, the Alternatives to Opioids. Director Shaw, you know, Senator Harmon has presented a unusual alternative here, and I wanted to just ask you sort of about our culture of thinking around addiction and the ideas that we have about how we should approach this problem. Because I think you joined us the last time we talked about this, I believe, Director Shaw, was in May, and you talked about how we need to change the way we discuss people who suffer from opioid addiction. And instead of stigmatizing them, we need to recognize them as our neighbors. As you said, we need to bring them into the fold. And I wonder how much of this is a cultural change also about understanding the role of addiction. I think a lot of people tend to think that maybe addicts just need better self-control or emotional help to overcome, for example, an opioid addiction.
You're absolutely right, Nyla. This is to really grapple with what substance use disorder means is going to require not just a conversation, but in many respects, a wholesale sea change in how we think about what addiction actually is. Even in medical school, when I was in medical school, there was this sense that addiction is somehow different. And doctors don't want to really deal with patients who are grappling with addiction. They want to deal with patients who have real healthcare problems. But what we know now is that addiction is really no different from any other healthcare problem. It's no different from hypertension and cancer and diabetes. It's a chronic brain disease that folks can relapse from, but that recovery is also possible, much in the same way of diabetes and cancer and hypertension. Now, changing that conversation is going to require a lot of things. The first is just what we're doing right now, which is discussing it in a public forum with me and you and Senator Herman. But the other thing it's really going to take is a flashpoint. In my lifetime, the last flashpoint there was in a conversation of this sort was around HIV, and in particular when Magic Johnson came out as being HIV positive. Almost overnight, HIV went from something that you didn't talk about to something that immediately everyone wanted to talk about. And we need to figure out a way to do that with respect to the opioid crisis. I'm not sure how that's going to be done, but certainly the first step is recognizing that there's a roadblock in place.
What, Senator Herman, do you think that lawmakers, I'm thinking just in particular in the State House, do you think that your colleagues are looking at this issue and willing to think about alternatives and kind of this, looking at this issue in the way that Dr. Shaw is framing it?
I do think so, and I think there's a broader acceptance across the state and across the country. We've seen with the opioid crisis, as we saw to some degree with the methamphetamine surge a decade or so ago, this is an issue that hits every community. It was too easy, in my opinion, for folks politically to view, say, crack cocaine as a problem in the city for black and brown people. And that was wrong. But now we're seeing people of all ages, of all neighborhoods in our city, rural, urban, suburban, everyone is grappling with this because it hits so close to home. It starts out, as Dr. Shaw said, with a legitimate prescription for painkillers for an appropriate setting, and then you quickly find you're addicted, and suddenly people are buying heroin to supplant their need for the opioid. So I think we need to do anything we can to socialize this to make sure people understand it is, as Dr. Shaw said, a disease and not a moral failing, but then we need to give people the tools to combat it.
Director Shaw, last month to that end, Governor Rauner signed an executive order creating an opioid overdose prevention and protection task force. You're chairing this along with Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. Can I ask you what measures this task force is taking up?
Absolutely. The purpose of the task force is, the task force is comprised of state agency directors. And the purpose of it is for us to come together and implement the various strategies that we set forth in the action plan that we released just a few months back. Some immediate things that we did were, first, for example, just a few weeks ago, the Illinois Department of Public Health issued a standing order. This is a standing order for a drug called naloxone, or what's often called Narcan. What this allows almost anyone in the state to do is to walk into a participating pharmacy and buy Narcan from the pharmacy without necessarily having a prescription from their own doctor. We realized that a lot of individuals and recovery programs were struggling with acquiring Narcan because they couldn't get a doctor to write a prescription for them. This was one of the strategies that we outlined in the action plan, and this was something that we were delighted to be able to deliver on. Another example of something that we're working on quite immediately is going online with a real-time mapping tool that allows us to know when there are overdoses that are occurring, again, in real time across the state. If we detect a spike in overdoses in a certain block or in a certain county, usually because of especially toxic heroin that's at the streets there, we're able to mobilize public health, healthcare, and law enforcement resources to get ahead of the problem, to let hospitals know that they may be expecting this, and even put the word out on the street. All that is possible because we're now going to be able to map these data in real time and respond to them accordingly.
I want to just ask you one last question, Director Shaw, about the budget situation, because when we were last discussing this, lawmakers in Springfield hadn't agreed on a budget. We've been talking for the past 2 years on the 21st to different social service providers about how, in particular, some places that had to close and shut their doors and could not provide addiction treatment services. I'm thinking about DeWitt County, for example. Obviously, now that there's been a budget, I wonder, are you seeing prevention and treatment programs, Director Shaw, the programs you're overseeing, are they funded at the levels they need to be?
Well, the budget impasse certainly didn't help. A protracted suspension of funding is never good for a situation of this nature. We are now seeing, now that the General Assembly and the governor have agreed to a spending plan, we are seeing providers coming back online. But funding is still a challenge. We know that downstate, for example, south of I-80, even worse, south of I-72, and even further worse as you go further south, that the number of dollars that are needed to sustain treatment and prevention programs is sorely lacking. And this has real consequences. Just in the past few years in Illinois, we project that there are roughly 250,000 individuals across the state who need access to substance abuse therapy but aren't able to find it because the places where they live in the state don't have the providers necessary. One big obstacle is improving the funding environment to allow those providers to come online and deliver those services. And so while we at the department commend our elected officials and the governor for agreeing on a plan, there's still more funding that's needed to really start tackling the process.
Nirav Shah is the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. I want to thank him and Senator Don Harmon for joining us to talk about the government response to the issue. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nile.
Thanks for having us.
I want to, to that point that Director Shaw was making about funding, bring in another person to this conversation. Sarah Howe is the CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. They represent 60 service providers across the state. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, as we think about just to kind of pick up on Director Shaw's point about the funding level, about the situation, when we last talked to you about this, things weren't looking really good. Can we just have a quick check in with you about what funding looks like for agencies and what the landscape of addiction treatment looks like across Illinois now?
Sure. Certainly, I think the last time we talked, we were right at the precipice or right after the time where we've seen a budget. So since that time, things have certainly stabilized across the field in the sense that, you know, having a budget certainly helped right up front. That means there are dollars flowing. They are still taking some time. We know there's a backlog of bills in the state. So we recognize that it was going to take some time for those dollars to get flowing to providers, but they are. The dollar amounts are still declining compared to where we were in previous years, and really over the past decade. Every fiscal year, we have seen less and less funding for addiction treatment. So that in of itself is obviously concerning, particularly in light of what we just heard from Director Shaw regarding, you know, the crisis that we're at and the need for resources to make sure that we are adequately addressing the system. However, I say that recognizing that we're certainly better off having a budget, having some stability. We're not necessarily seeing what we did 6 and 8 months ago, which is providers closing, programs closing, people that weren't able to get into the services in their community. That does still exist, please don't get me wrong. but we at least aren't seeing every day a different call where there may be another provider shutting down a program or shutting down their entire agency. So that's a much better situation than where we were.
We're going to take a break. Sarah, if you can stick around with us, I want to continue this conversation with you about how providers are handling this. I'm curious also your response to President Trump's declaration about the opioid crisis being a public health emergency. We're going to pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break if you hang with us. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the amount of people who have died in the U.S. from drug overdoses. The national number, more than about 64,000 people. To give you a sense of that, that's enough people to fill Soldier Field. How many people in Illinois have died from drug overdose deaths? Last year, about 2,200, almost 1,900 of those from opioid addictions. My guest is Sarah Howe. She's the CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. They represent 60 service providers across the state. Sarah, you were saying just before the break that agencies have recovered. Would you say they've fully recovered from the damage that the budget crisis has caused? Because you're saying at least agencies aren't shutting down, but did the ones that shut down reopen? Where are we at with that?
Absolutely not. A full recovery will take years. It took years to get to this point. It's going to take years to recover from it. Those that did shut down did not reopen. So right away, those communities that lost those services have not seen those agencies reopen. In some cases, other agencies did try to pick up as many individuals as they could and tried to expand their service capacity. But again, with a system that was already really stretched, that makes it a little challenging to say that, yes, they were able to bring everybody in. So the first thing is, no, we have not seen them recover. We have not seen all those communities get those services back, and it will take quite a bit of time.
Are you optimistic, Sarah, that more federal attention, like the president declaring this a public health emergency, may translate into more action on this issue?
We're reserving judgment on that one. I think we're really pleased to see that there is a public health emergency declared. I think it's almost goes without saying. It's a little bit late in the sense that we've known that there was a crisis, and the CDC actually defined this as an epidemic over a year ago. So we've known that we were having a public health emergency. To have the weight of the White House behind it never hurts. There's no doubt about that. But we're still reserving some judgment because, as what you heard from your previous guests, we haven't seen additional dollars. We haven't seen additional resources. We really like the emphasis on prevention and treatment. There's some talk regarding some of the federal regulations, like the IMD exclusion, which limits it's a bed limit exclusion within the federal government. They want to look at that, which could really help. But, you know, we also really need to look at the resources. Medicaid takes care of a lot of services right now, and at the same time, we're looking at the federal government potentially dismantling the expansion of Medicaid. So all of this interacts with one another, so it's hard to just say, this was great, good job, we're finally on the right track. There's a lot more that needs to be done, and we need to peel a lot more of the layers back.
What do you want our state leaders to be doing, Sarah?
I think what you're hearing from our leaders is that they are on track paying attention to this issue. That's the first thing. But bottom line, at the end of the day, budgets are a reflection of priorities. And we have yet to see a budget in the past 10 years that has prioritized addiction services, period. We've even seen recently where we've seen a rate increase be put in place for the Division of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, and then it only went for one service. You know, these types of things continue to happen where it sounds great that we're doing a lot of work, but then when you dig into the details, we're not seeing actual dollars translate in terms of an increase. And that's a reflection of priorities.
Sarah, as we think about this, as we think about how many people this touches, a tweet from actually WBEZ sports contributor Cheryl Ray Stout, who's listening, saying that this is such a devastating addiction. She lost a family member who was in rehab a few times, found a number of prescriptions in her nightstand to opioids, unfortunately. What do you want people who are listening to know about this issue?
You know, I think the first thing is to get yourself educated. I mean, just that tweet right there is very important in people recognizing what is out there, what's in your medicine cabinet. The DEA does prescription drug take-back days. They say they could collect far more than what they see. We're just really scratching the surface, I think, on the education, and I believe Director Shaw said that programs like this are really important to understand if you're a parent, what are the signs, what to look for, get educated. I would also say I think it's really important to get educated about the treatment system and what help is available. Unfortunately, we can do an entire show on what is happening regarding some providers that have popped up in other states mostly but are taking advantage of people in Illinois that are not good providers, that are taking people's money, are flying them other places, and they're getting into these centers that are allowing them to continue to use. They're in having poor life safety standards, and parents and family members just want to find somebody help. So when the first thing they do is look to get help and they see, hey, this is a great opportunity, I can get my kid over there, finally somewhere where they can go and be safe, and then they're finding they're not safe. So one of the things that we really have started to try to do is educate people on what to look for, just from the treatment system. Make sure it's a licensed provider. You don't necessarily need to leave your home in your home state to find a good provider. There are federal resources. There's a treatment locator on the federal government's website. Get yourself educated now. Oftentimes, we don't know about these things until we need it, and sometimes that's too late to really get up to speed. And there are groups such as ours that can help people with those educational resources.
That's Sarah Howe, CEO of the Illinois Behavioral Health Association. Sarah, thanks for being with me to discuss this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
On Mondays, we like to talk Illinois politics. Lots going on in the past week. Governor Rauner's bid for re-election may not have him coasting straight to general election. State Representative Jeannie Ives is gathering signatures. It's a first step in plans to take on the incumbent in the Republican primary. It's been a tough couple of weeks for the governor. We want to talk about what happened during the veto session last week. It's Monday. Joining me on the line, two political reporters. Ray Hodge is a Springfield editor of The Daily Line. Tony Arnold is WBEZ's political reporter. Ray, Tony, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Good to
Hi, Nyla. Hi, Tony. Good to be back with you all.
Let's start asking both of you a quick question. Ray, the veto roundup, how did Governor Rauner fare in this?
You know, there are a few things here that I think, you know, from a moderate Republican standpoint, I think he might be able to get behind. But, you know, overall, there were several overrides here. And so, you know, from any position of an executive, you're going to have to take that in stride. And and I think we may end up seeing that become a greater and greater part of his campaign as things go on, because the exercise of legislative power was pretty obvious there.
Right. So, Tony, we're looking at lawmakers. They overrode the governor on 14 bills, sustained vetoes on 3 bills. Tony, to you, what stands out here?
Well, for just to clarify one thing, nothing's been completely overridden yet. There's been almost a dozen bills that the House of Representatives voted to override the governor on, but those still need to go to the Senate. And the Senate has overridden 3 different bills, I think. Now we're up to 3, I think, that now have to go to the House of Representatives.
And, oh, okay, thanks for clarifying that.
So nothing's quite done yet. That said, this is all an indication here of just kind of the some of the anger that's out there from the Republican side against Governor Rauner, particularly over his signing of this abortion bill a couple months ago now, that's still very present. And the reason this is all kind of factoring in together is because for Governor Rauner's first two terms, he vetoed, you know, any number of bills and was hardly ever overridden by the legislature. You know, it was a big deal. I remember when a Chicago pensions bill was overridden. I think it was last year. And so now to see, you know, Thursday was very dramatic, or I should say last Wednesday was very dramatic because it, bill after bill after bill just kept coming up, and Rauner kept getting his veto was overridden, whether he had just outright vetoed it altogether or just changed part of it. And so to see nearly a dozen bills now of Rauner's going against Rauner's wishes is a very substantial change from where things have been for the last 2 years. And these bills, you know, if you want to talk about what was in them, there are any number of different things. I don't know if we want to go down the whole list of a dozen of them, but, you know, one of them is it's everything from mandating teachers in schools teach cursive writing to how transparent state agencies are with how much debt they have, how many bills they're sitting on. It's a whole gamut of different issues going on here that the House is that the House voted to override last week.
Ray, when we think about that, I wonder if really quickly if you could just point out, you know, obviously we don't want to go through all dozen of them, but to you, what stands out are the most important ones that are being debated during this veto session, which, you know, obviously continues.
Well, I mean, to say which are most important, I think might be a little subjective, but I do know, and I can tell you, which ones have kind of made the most splash or have seen the most support. Obviously, we've seen a lot of splash from the bump stock ban bill. You know, that's a perhaps a different matter, but it did dominate quite a bit of coverage. The student loan protection bill, that one definitely saw a huge amount of attention. And then we also have the Debt Transparency Act from Comptroller, or widely supported by Comptroller Mendoza. Those three seem to have gained quite a bit of traction. There was a lot of press conferences going on around them. There was a lot of people responding to them back and forth. And I think those are the ones that we'll see quite a bit of action on in the next coming week as well.
And so, go ahead, Tony.
I would just add in, you know, looking at, you know, this is, you know, the way that Springfield works. Last week was week one of the veto session. Then they take this week off. Then they come back for three more days next week. I think week one was pretty dramatic. I think week two is going to be, you're going to see that step go up a notch even, partially because there's one bill that actually Rauner was able, the Republicans did stick with Rauner on. That bill would basically criminalize or make it illegal for local municipalities, local cities, or you know, districts to go to right-to-work zones, basically pass anti-union laws. And Rauner vetoed that bill when it passed, and he was, by one vote, was able to keep his veto in place. Now, it sounds like Democrats are going to try again to override next week. This is kind of the big bill because Rauner's made so much of union policy such a big part of his term in office, and this is seen as one of the really big ones to watch to see if the Democrats can all hold together to actually override that one in the House.
Yeah, and Tony, as you talk about sort of the excitement of last week, I think probably the biggest headlines were also around sexual harassment and a culture of misogyny in the state capitol. We talked to legislators and activists about that last week. In fact, here's Senator Toy Hutchinson speaking to us about this.
Every single woman we know has a Me Too story. So it wasn't something that I could see and read and not sign on to. So it's been a fascinating last couple of days, really watching how people are processing this and what people are saying as a result of this agitation that's happened in the Capitol now.
2 minutes left. But, Ray, I just want to ask you really quickly about that legislation, what the reaction has been.
Sure. We've got a wide range of reactions here. Obviously, lawmakers right now that I've been speaking to are looking for any way to address this, this enormous cloud that's sort of hanging over the legislature at this point. What we are scheduled for tomorrow is a 10 a.m. Committee meeting where House Speaker Michael Madigan's sponsored bill that Hutchinson was speaking about there, SB 402, House Amendment 2, will be heard in a committee tomorrow in Chicago. So we're going to see more of that starting to come out. But basically the reaction to this as far as that legislation is from the women's rights groups, whether that's the ERA Action Groups or the AAUW women's groups or, you know, any of the other ones that have been speaking with me at least. The reaction is that they are very concerned that this is going to be all talk and no teeth. They're very concerned that the way to address it as written in this bill is only a once-a-year annual training session. They are very concerned that a once-a-year training session may not be sufficient to really change the culture in an impactful way for many of these women. Specifically, they're citing some Harvard studies that have demonstrated that certain types of anti-harassment training can even, you know, counterintuitively do the opposite of this. So there's still a lot of advocacy work, and this story is the momentum of it is still sort of unfolding. So the lawmakers that I've spoken to are looking at this first bill coming up as one part of a way to address this, and they are certainly looking for other ways to address it. The main flaw of this bill, as noted by, you know, several of the either the advocates or the opponents, is that it relies on the, you know, the ethics officers of the state legislature to really do this. To enforce these things or to hold these sort of training sessions.
Yeah, Ray, I'm afraid we're out of time. So I want to thank you for that. We'll have to follow up with that as well as Jeannie Ives' announcement that she may be running against Governor Rauner. I want to thank Tony Arnold, Ray Hodge for being with me here on the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in.